Access number 27811, Major Richard Wilson, Reel 14. Now, we're talking about the amalgamation process in August 1959. Mm. Now, you mentioned the two regiments, the Norfolks and the Suffolks, were very different. Now, to outsiders, they don't appear so different. I mean,
I would say that the Norfolks, partially because, of course, they'd been in Germany for quite a long time, were, in a soldier's terms, a bullshit mob or outfit. Whereas the Suffolks were Suffolk Swedes. Because we'd only just got back from Cyprus and one thing and another, we weren't very amenable to drill and all the things that one had to do as a battalion in Germany. And we wore brown boots and brown berets, and we were, I think, very different at that time. And obviously, they had, you know, we had to form a new regiment. And okay, the Norfolks have it being in situ, it was easier to form to their way of doing things than it was to the Suffolk way of doing things. But this took actually a bit of sort of getting used to, and it was decided to have a huge amalgamation parade about a month after we'd all got to Eastleigh, and this of course meant masses of square bashing and everything, which the Suffolk side didn't take very kindly to, and certainly a lot of the Suffolk officers didn't. And then, which it actually arrived eventually in total stupidity, because Jonathan Hall Tipping got very fed up with the Suffolk officers not doing their drill properly. And so in the end, he said, right, well, on one morning, we will all parade at 5 o'clock in the morning or some such time. Well, of course, it was pretty well pitch dark when we got out on the square. And he started running us around the square and everything, but he couldn't see where we were. And so, he quite honestly, he finished up with the sort of Norfolks at one end of the square and the Suffolks ambling along at another end of the square. And so we had a few instances like that, but then it all got going. We had the parade, that was fine.
What do you remember of the parade? Because some people...
It must have been quite a big parade. Obviously, the sort of GOC obviously came and...
But you don't remember it much?
I don't know. There obviously must have been some formality about it, and there must have been... I can't remember whether we had two... whether we had two Norfolk companies and two Suffolk companies, and we sort of came together, I can't quite remember, but there probably was something like that.
Now, one thing that might be said is that, and you've almost indicated yourself, was that the Norfolk swallowed the Suffolks or the first, you know, and that the new regiment, 1st Battalion East Anglia Regiment, was in fact the Norfolks with a big draft of Suffolks, you know. Now, how would you respond to that? I mean, is the truth, I mean, there, you know.
I think immediately, we probably were swallowed in that they were in situ. They hadn't had to move, whereas we had. And I suppose it was like a large draft arriving with them and being absorbed into the battalion. So to start, the initiative was definitely with them on that. And not that I think it caused... I don't think it caused any ill feeling. I can't remember there being any ill feeling. There was no ill feeling in the mess.
Well, the officer's mess is a key indicator, and the sergeant's mess. How were things? And well, firstly, the officer's mess.
Well, the officer's mess, as I remember it, I mean, integrated very quickly. I mean, naturally, there would be a few days of possibly the Norfolks being in one corner and the Suffolks in the other, because that's where you know your friends. You'd had to make new friends. I knew very few Norfolk officers, and I suspect all my brother officers in the Suffolks were the same. So we'd all got to make new friends in Oresford. So to start with, we probably kept to ourselves a little bit, but I think that was that very soon. I think we amalgamated very well and very quickly.
Within the officers' mess, were you still Norfolks and Suffolks?
For a period, yes, it must have been. I don't know, a matter of months, but after possibly. But I think Bill Murray Brown handled it. It very well, because on an occasion like this, the quicker you can get your companies formed and mix you all up, and then get you busy, and get you out on exercise, and doing things, so you haven't actually got then time to think about Christ, whether I Norfolk or whether I Suffolk or whatever it is. I mean, you know, his job was to get two groups of people together and thinking of themselves as First East Anglian rather than Royal Norfolk or Suffolk. And I would have said he achieved that very well.
Now, how did it go in the sergeant's mess? Because in a way, the sergeants are long-serving regulars. They can't just be got rid of. Yet there's half as many senior positions in one battalion as there were in two. I mean, did the process of integration go well in the sergeant's mess?
As far as I know, I don't think there were any particular problems. I'm sure there were a number on an individual basis, but I don't think there was any sort of long-standing problems. But then I didn't have a lot to do with the sergeant's mess, so it would really need a member of the sergeant's mess to, you know, they might say differently. I don't know.
You weren't aware of trouble.
No.
Now, what your own thing was that you were second in command to a Norfolk officer, and that was, I've forgotten his first name, if you mentioned Atthill.
Andrew Atthill.
He was the major commanding. We're not quite sure what company, but
it was A Company.
Now, what was he like?
He was a splendid man. He was a real soldier's commander. He was a tremendous outdoor man, a very fine shot. Had been sort of game hunting in East Africa, and I would have said a very, very popular a company commander. I got on terribly well with him, and no problems at all. And we used to go up to the Baltic and shooting geese and that sort of thing. So we got on very well, and he was a friend of mine for the rest of his life. He died last year in 2005. But he was very, very good on that. And as I say, we were kept very busy, lots of exercises.
And what were the exercises like in Germany?
They were much the same as I've said before when I was in Wuppertal with the Suffolk.
The
role in Germany had not altered it over the years. It was the same. I can't remember how much longer we spent in Iselone, when we were sent up to Berlin. And that was probably a very wise move, because if there were still any amalgamation problems, which I don't think there were, but if there had been, then here we were as a unit moving for the first time, all together, being sent up to do a new job in a new place. If there had been any problems, that would have pulled everybody together. And Bill Murray Brown was still commanding. He took us up to Berlin, where he was still commanding then.
Which barracks did you go into?
We went into the barracks out at Gatow. We were right on the border. In fact, you looked out of the mess windows, and there was the wire and East German soldiers patrolling. What was the name of the barracks? I shall remember. It was the ones that were. There was one set of barracks right outside Berlin, and the others were sort of in at Spandau and that sort of thing. I think there was Berlin Brigade, so there must have been three battalions in Berlin. I can't remember who the other battalions were at this stage.
Now, did the proximity to the Berlin Wall, did that lead you... I mean, were you aware of the Soviet threat or becoming more aware of it at this time?
Well, when we moved, of course, there was no wall. The wall had not gone up. There was Berlin, which... And surrounds out to sort of Potsdam and the rest of it, which... I suppose had a perimeter, I don't know, 100 miles or whatever it was, if you walked the whole way round, might be more. And that was wired the whole way round. And then within that was Berlin, divided into the four sectors, French, Russian, American, and ourselves. And we could move quite... I'm not quite sure about the Russian sector. I'm not quite sure whether we could move easily into there, but we could run around. In fact, we used to go to the American Club and the French Officers Club and that sort of thing. But this was before the wall went up, because we're not really very long after the war when we come, you know, to think of it. And certainly we used to go across into the East German and oblique, I suppose, Russian sector, particularly to go to the opera, because they had very fine opera. Well, first of all, perhaps one should say there was a tremendous difference between the American, French, and British zones, and then going into the East German, Russian zone, which still looked as if the war had finished yesterday, and all the buildings were pockmarked with bullets and the rest of it. Most of them were totally derelict, and there was obviously extreme poverty. There was nothing in the shops. The exchange rate was excellent, because you got about five times as many marks for East German marks for the West German marks. So if you could find anything to buy, it was well worth it. And the only things you could find would be sort of long playing records and a certain amount of china. Was the only things that you could buy, and it was very, very poverty stricken. But they still had marvelous opera, and whenever we went to the opera, we always went in mess kit. And you would, at the interval you'd be having a glass of wine or whatever it is, and then you'd feel people behind you, and they would actually be feeling the cloth of your mesket, because they hadn't seen that standard of clothing, etc., for such a long time. And it really brought it home to you. How very, very poverty stricken these people were, and what a split country it now was. Because down in the zone, it was now recovering quite well. And if you went to Eastleigh, Dortmund places, life was fairly normal. But life was certainly not normal in the eastern zone of Berlin.
Now, was there any perception of threat, a Soviet threat in 1959? I mean, there was in the 60s, but had it started then?
I suppose there was a lot of yes, I think there was a lot of fear, probably, of the, of what. I mean, if the Soviets had suddenly decided that they wanted to take Berlin, one wonders actually what we really could have done about it. Because, I mean, we were living on a little island in the middle of the Russian zone. The actual Russian border was 80 miles down the line by train or whatever it is. I mean, to get into Berlin, you went to Helmstedt. There was the road in, but the main way in was by train. And you went to Helmstedt, and there the Russians sort of came on board and marched around the train to see what was on it and all the rest of it. And then you came through the Russian zone into the island, is probably the best way of putting it, of Berlin. So if the Russians had suddenly decided they were going to take Berlin, I presume it wouldn't have actually been very difficult, because we would have had them all round us. There wouldn't have been one front. There would have been, God knows. But we did do exercises and things, and I suspect there must have been some sort of plan if that was to happen. But I can't remember what it was, and I don't think I probably want to know. but yes, I mean, very different to today. I mean, there wasn't just fear of a threat. You could see all the East Germans clearly living in great fear of the Russian. I think they had a very like any of the countries that Russia took over, must have been very, very unpleasant.
Now, so what was happening? You were second in command of your company, under.
I was second in command of my company. I think for a period I had command of a company, but I can't remember which company it was. I think it was C Company, probably.
What was your role as company commander? It's obvious what it is in a way, but what would you say as?
I think one of the problems of Berlin. I mean, the British zone was. Each zone was pretty small, and really, it was keeping and managing to think up enough things for your troops to do. You couldn't do any vast exercises because we hadn't got the ground on which to exercise. So we used to do. We did a lot of shooting. I think we had a range within the camp. But really, it was trying to have doing different things to keep the troops amused, day in, day out. I mean, we had certain things we had to do, like guarding Spandau prison, and I think that took a company. Although,
now, did you ever do that?
Yes, I did that. I think the only inmate at the time was Hess.
Now, what do you remember of that? The whole Spandau prison business.
Well, we didn't have really anything to do with Hess, and if there was anybody else in there, there might have been two or three actually at that time. Hess was certainly one. I mean, the prison had its own sort of internal jailers, as it were, and then you went in as a company and you manned, rather like a sort of POW prison camp, you manned the perimeter wires and the towers and the rest of it. I suppose the best way of putting it is you were there to support the internal jailers should there have been a problem. But the thought of there being a problem, at most there were three war prisoners in there, with probably about 70 soldiers around the perimeter or waiting to go on duty or whatever it is. So, you know, the chances of there being a problem were, I would have thought, practically nil on that. I can't remember ever sort of patrolling the wire, rather like we used to see them patrolling the wire. And of course it was some time after the airlift, which I think was 48, I think, wasn't it, something like that. So I, from a troop's point of view, probably one of the biggest things was trying to relieve boredom.
Was there any disciplinary problems? Bored troops can lead to disciplinary problems.
I don't think so. I think we managed to keep them as unbored as we could. I mean, I personally, I used to ride in those days, and we had a riding club in the barracks, and we had a number of horses. I used to go out riding before breakfast every morning around the Havel, which was actually lovely. But you know, that was fine for me. And then we used to every now and then we'd put our horses on the back of the train and go down to the zone to take part in the horse shows in the zone.
What kind of horse shows? Tell us a bit about them.
What sort of horses?
Horse shows.
Horse shows. Well, the zone used to have quite a lot of horse shows. Rheindahlen and places, they all, jumping, dressage, etc. But I mean, that was rather a sort of officer sergeant sort of sport. Rather not. There were a few soldiers who liked riding and who came down with it. It was an all ranks thing, but obviously not many of them.
Were they your own horses, or were they sort of hired?
I think they were our own horses. I think we bought. No, not individually. I think they were bought by the regiment. I think they were sort of regimental horses. We must have had some stabling there, which, being a big German barracks, was probably all there. And we certainly had a pig farm, we used to have to make money for the PRI. And I don't know whether we supplied the sort of the officers of science mess with pig. We probably did, I don't know. But we certainly had a pig farm, which I, and the pigs were fed on all the swill from the cookhouse and the like.
And what about the ordinary men? What were their activities?
Well, there was all the normal sport, a lot of football, for that, hockey, boxing, and sort of all the normal pastimes, and there'd be a lot of sort of, and shooting. There'd be a lot of, you know, intercompany football, intercompany hockey, and you get quite a good sort of intercompany network going, which sort of kept them. And then a lot of the time, I mean, we were on exercises of, you know, of a sort, but we didn't have very far to go before you came up against another patch of wire.
So would the men go out into Berlin to the cinemas?
Oh yes, the clubs? Yes. That was no problem. There was no. I mean, we were quite. We were all quite friendly with the civilian, population, and there were NAFI clubs and all that sort of thing. We used to go down to Berlin. We all had our cars there, and we had one splendid officer who I may have mentioned before, Harold Wigington, and he arrived with his Rolls Royce, which got actually it broke down at Helmstedt. So he came up by train and then wanted one or two people to take him down and come back with him. So I went down with my car to Helmstedt to bring this Rolls back into Berlin. Wiggy was the sort of chap he got on with anybody. So we got down to Helmstedt and there were all these very ferocious looking guards and Russian guards, etc. But in sort of 5 minutes, we had them all round a table in hysterics. He had a few more people like him. We possibly wouldn't have all the fraught wars and things we've got today. This, of course, the Rolls Royce in Berlin in those days was quite something. It was quite a big car, and not many Germans had. I mean, there were German cars, there were lots of Volkswagens and things, but they were, as I said before, they were very poor, and there wasn't a lot. But the soldiery, they could go down. I don't remember having hosts of soldiers up on orders because they'd made a fracas down in Berlin. I think we all got on all right.
Not too much drunkenness in the town.
No, I'd say no. And several times probably during the year we'd either go down as companies, and occasionally as battalion, and exercise in the zone. Go down to Sennelager, for example, and probably go down to Sennelager for a month. Where we could exercise properly and field firing on the ranges there, could do quite big exercises. And then we used to go up to Paderborn and do tank training with the cavalry. And obviously, the more you could do, get them out, the better. On that, and that really was our sort of life. I enjoyed Berlin. It was a very interesting city, and I have been back since. And now, of course, it's a huge, thriving place. But it was still recovering from the war when we very much so when we were there.